Looking to refresh your closet, home, or beauty routine this spring? Walmart's got all the stylish goods in one stop. From chic new looks and the latest makeup to quality furniture and tableware. Go to walmart.com/nowtrending. That's walmart.com/nowtrending for the hottest fashion, home, and beauty finds. Your style at Walmart.
I'm going to whisper some things to you now about Crunch chocolate bars, because apparently this whispering thing is a thing that makes you feel things. It's saying something crunchy is coming in the candy wrapper language. Imagine your tongue hiking up those crispy, rocky ridges. Now, drum roll, please.
Wow, that's good. Crunchy, munchy chocolate doesn't whisper.
Turn up the fun with Crunch.
Welcome to the Radio Times podcast with me, Kellyanne Taylor. In this series, I sit down on the Radio Times sofa with a different celebrity guest every week to talk all things telly. What do they watch? Where do they watch it? And who do they watch with? Each week, we glimpse into my guest's life as seen through the prism of TV and from the vantage point of their sofas. We also delve into their own glittering careers on screen. This week's guest is the actor Penn Badgley, who rose to fame playing Dan Humphrey in the American teen drama Gossip Girl, and is currently starring in Netflix's hit series You. In this episode, Penn talks to me about being a child actor in LA.
Your parents need to be supportive. They also need to be a little crazy to be letting you cross that threshold into becoming a professional actor at a young age.
And we talk about the impact adults playing teenagers has on young viewers, and why the TV industry needs to reassess its portrayal of sex scenes. Penn, welcome to the Radio Times podcast.
Thank you for having me.
Let's start. First and foremost, what is the view from your sofa?
The view from my sofa? You mean here or back
home? At home.
At home.
When you're watching TV.
Oh, that's what you mean.
Yes.
I literally was thinking, wait, where is my sofa? Okay, it's there. And I'm thinking of my view and I'm thinking, okay, there's a window. What is the view from my sofa? That is the most elegant way to ask somebody what they're watching on television.
That's where we're going.
Yeah. What is the view from my sofa? You know, recently, like I sat on the remote when I was reading something with my toddler. I have a 14-year-old and a 2.5-year-old. And we don't watch a lot of TV with him at all. And he doesn't yet understand or know that I'm, you know, on TV. Except, so I sat on the remote and Netflix came on, just the opening screen, and my huge face was right there. And he goes, "That's Daddy?
Oh,
that's Daddy?" And I was looking for the remote because I knew the preview would start to play. And then I was like, "Where's the remote? Where's the remote?" I'm like looking all around for it, because that's not a good preview for a 2.5-year-old to see, especially when he thinks it's his father. That was the most recent view. Like that happened just
that
a few days ago. We watch. Here's where we sound so basic. We watch The Voice.
The
U.S. version. I don't know if you're familiar with the U.S. version, but we watch the U.S. version because it really makes the most sense for all the age gaps.
Yeah, I can see that.
Yeah, and actually, there's a spirit to it that is incredibly wholesome and sweet, and we all love music, and so it's just nice to see people singing.
My mother thinks that I am the best person in the world, and
she wants you to go on The Voice, doesn't she?
Yeah, I have the worst singing voice in the world. And she plays a game. Well, she tells me that if I was on The Voice, I would win, or that someone would turn around for me. It's not
true. Sure.
However, she plays, so she turns around, so she plays along, and then she'll, you know, physically move herself around, so she watches it. So, you know, The Voice is. It's a lovely, wholesome watch.
It clearly inspires a lot of people, and we like it. The only things I watch with my 2.5-year-old are The Voice and Planet Earth.
Oh my god, Planet Earth, epic! Yeah. Okay, talk me through your living room setup. Do you have big sofa, big screen, very minimalist? Can you hide the TV?
Mm-hmm. No, actually, my wife, at some point, she got this TV. She switched our TVs without checking with me, which is fine. Shout out to my wife. Hey, baby. It's huge, but it is flat. It's very, very, very flat. It's like one of these ones that can look like a picture frame.
Love it. Yeah.
And
that you're so scared to knock. I'd just be terrified to have that in.
Well, no, I mean it's very secure on there, and these pictures come up that look like art, and that's
beautiful.
Kind of, you know, it's kind of nice. It's kind of nice, but it's to me it's a disconcertingly, like when we're watching it, sometimes my eyes hurt personally, and I turn the brightness away. I sound like an 80-year-old man, by the way, which actually reminds me.
No judgment.
The third thing that we watch with our youngest is Amazing Grace, the Aretha Franklin like documentary that's all of her gospel songs, because he loves her gospel songs. So that's
So I was going to ask you who controls the remote in your household, but it sounds like it might be.
It's the children. When you have children, it's really the children who control the remote.
They get what
and they should,
want.
By the way. They mm-hmm. shouldn't control it. You should be watching everything with them in mind, and you control it. Right, that's like control.
I like
sounds
this.
Kind of extreme in that case, but
yes, okay.
Come on, some discipline, guys. Yeah. There's nothing but lax parenthood around. No, they're not going to tell us what they want to watch. They're gonna share what they would prefer,
yeah.
And then we find the thing that will sort of keep everyone interested. And so far, to be honest, our 14-year-old is sort of frustrated with that. He's like, it's basketball for him.
Okay, is there anything that you loathe on TV that if it comes on, you think
loathe? No. No, I mean, loathe is a strong... No, so to be real, most reality television is just hard for me.
Yeah.
Most television is hard for me. I've been making it over two-thirds of my life now.
Yes.
And I see the formulas so immediately. There's so few things that I can enjoy, to be honest.
Really?
Yeah, really.
Okay, what was the last thing you enjoyed?
I think it was The Crown, actually.
Okay.
Yeah.
That's good choice.
Yeah, I mean, you know... Yeah. Again, I may still be an 80-year-old man. It's fine.
Okay, I want to take it back to childhood and talk me through your first ever TV memory.
Huh. So the first things that come to mind are all the Nickelodeon shows of the 90s, like Rocco's Modern Life, Ah, Real Monsters, all that.
Mm.
You're younger than me, so
yeah. Nickelodeon was banned in my household. Yeah.
Banned in your
household?
Yeah,
I started speaking with an American accent, and my parents were like, "Ken, you're watching too much TV."
Wow.
Yeah.
Wow, okay.
We went too far.
Yeah,
should have been parental guidance.
Yeah, right.
Didn't happen.
Yeah, it was all those Nickelodeon shows. Like, Are You Afraid of the Dark? Yeah, those are the ones. First television? I think that's it, yeah.
When did you know that you wanted to become an actor?
The opening night of the first play that I was in, I had done some stuff in school, but when I did community theater, for the first time, I was 9, I think. And opening night, I had like a significant... I was like the only main role for a child in a play for adults. And it was just the experience of being in a cast, I think.
Mm-hmm.
That communal experience. People of all ages, kind of, you know? And sometimes all walks of life. That was, I think, the thing that I responded to most. Yes, the craft and the art is definitely something that I was drawn to, but that can't be all because it's so collaborative. You have to really love being with the people too, you know?
And you say you were 9 when you first got into it. So how do you even begin then to break into the industry? You know, were parents supportive? Parents happy for you?
Yeah, at that age, your parents need to be supportive. They also need to be a little crazy to be letting you cross that threshold into becoming a professional actor at a young age. It's definitely not advisable for virtually all parents. And I think, you know, I've said this before, it's no secret. When any child is going into the business, as you say, past a certain point. Now, I think if kids are going to performing school, you know, performing arts schools, and then they're studying, and then they really do the professional thing later. I think that's a bit different. But when you get kids going to LA at like, you know, 5 or 9 or 10 or 12 years old, almost across the board, it's because the parents probably are splitting up.
Right.
I'm not kidding. It's like it's almost across the board. They may not ever, or it may have already happened, but there has to be some kind of reason to leave. You know what I'm saying? So there has to be a reason to leave. And then what Hollywood is actually both it's like an escape, and also it's an oasis. You know, it's like a dream. You're kind of living out a dream with one of your parents, and that is it's a complex thing. And the reason I'm giving you this length and depth of an answer is because the truth is, I mean, you look at the kind of case studies we have of child actors, we know that's not a good thing, right? So I think we should recognize why it's not a good thing, as opposed to just being like, oh, it's not a good thing. You know, it's because to uproot your life and to, to just make this drastic decision where the child is usually going to be taken out of school a lot.
Yeah, because surely there's no consistency there. As
none,
You know, if you get taken for a part, you're going to be pulled out of school.
Right, exactly.
And are schools okay with that?
Well, it depends on what school you're going to.
Okay.
And so then kids usually end up going to these kinds of schools that are okay with it, but guess what? They're not really schools.
Yeah.
You know, and so then, and so I didn't really personally have much of an academic path after 12 years old.
Okay.
You know, I didn't go to high school. Went to high school for like 3 weeks after having already tested beyond high school in order to work adult hours. And I, you know, and I grew up alongside people who have lived, we all lived the story of like, I think why you shouldn't do this.
Right. Does it become kind of an environment where it's easy to be influenced or there's lots of distractions or things that, you know, for the average person, you know, I grew up in not this environment.
Yeah, right.
You know,
I
got the bus to school, did my hours and then went home and, you know, started drinking at like 18 or whatever. Yeah. Okay. A little bit younger, sorry, Mum. But, you know, I didn't have this kind of, like, high life. So surely there's also that excitement.
Well, yes, but the excitement is completely superficial, to be honest. I mean, yeah, is the excitement drinking earlier?
Oh, how exciting! How lovely! You can get started early, my dear.
Yeah, I mean, so here, I'll give you the most positive spin, and then, you know, maybe we could tap into the other one. It was a true joy to experience culture through art.
Mm.
Now, I'm not saying that's what you get when you're like starring in TV shows as a kid. In fact, I think as a kid, and starring in a show, that's really not what's happening. But as you get into it, and you are hopefully like, you know, you're also studying a craft and not just trying to become a famous like TV actor or whatever. Which, by the way, is not always, like, sometimes that's just what kids are doing and they're not really exploring the craft, art of it. But if you are exploring the art and craft of it, well, then actually you're learning.
Yeah.
You're constantly learning. You're constantly reading. You're performing. You're trying. You're failing. You're learning how to weather rejection. Probably too much, but, you know, but there are incredible life lessons that are there.
Yeah.
It's just that they come along with such other toxic lessons that I think that you can't really say.
Like what?
Well, first, I do just want to say that it would simply be naive to think that, oh, this is just good. This is just a good thing for somebody to do. Oh, how nice it is that you got started young, you know? So just to be clear about that. And some of those toxic things, I mean, body image right there at the top, especially for girls. I mean, again, how many more case studies do we need to see?
Well, I listened to your podcast with Leighton yesterday, and in it she was saying this thing, which is something that everyone struggles with, but she was saying, you know, we live in this society where everything we create is, or everything that's thrust upon us is for a product. It's capitalism, and when for her, she was obviously involved in it in the sense that people would turn around and say, you know, you need to look like this, or you need to dye your hair, or whatever, in a way that, you know, someone outside of that isn't going to maybe have directly thrust upon them. But you're going to get comments more so than anyone else, you know, even with the kind of growth of social media, which perhaps I don't think maybe was as big of a thing when you got cast as
Dan. Dan. Certainly. I mean, it was just becoming a thing.
But then also you had the dealing with the papers more, I guess, or the kind of weekly magazines that were coming out. So what was that like?
Well, I mean, there's a lot there. I think nobody anticipated how social media would effectively be the... It was putting the power of the paparazzi in the hands of the individual and then the individual wielding it on itself.
Yeah.
Which is strange. Mm. Nobody anticipated that, the turning around of the camera, you know? Like, oh, I'm going to do this to myself now.
Yeah, okay.
That Gossip Girl doesn't even have the same relevance in some ways, you know what I mean? Like, it just doesn't... The whole point of Gossip Girl was that she was spying on people. She doesn't need to spy on people with social media. You know what I mean? Like,
people
they're just doing
just
it.
Just letting
they're
you
just
know.
Telling you what's happening. So we did go through that at a really interesting, unique time.
Yeah. And that was the era. I mean, this was now me growing up.
Yeah.
But like, you know, all of those shows, 90210, The OC, One Tree Hill, these kind of American dramas that made you feel crazy things about, like, oh my God, that's what it's like to be older and this is what's going on.
Because we were all like 25.
Yeah, well, I had, I'd say my January early life crisis happened because I was watching Cheaper by the Dozen, which is supposed to be a feel-good film, and it is. But then I started realizing that the people that were playing teenagers, that when I was a kid watching it, I was like, oh, they're so old. And now I'm looking at them and I'm like, oh my God, they're my age. I couldn't play that person because they're way older.
Sure, but it's not way older. You know what it is that being a teenager is you're still so plastic. You're still growing so much. And sort of, I think there's something that we don't give a lot of attention to, but is surprisingly odd that we depict teenagers, again, who are still so, they're growing, you know? We take people who've grown.
Yeah.
And put them in those positions. So therefore, all the things that they're doing, typically sex, drugs, all that stuff, it's less funny, it's less exciting when you actually see teenagers doing it.
Yes.
You
know?
And so that's, to me, that's the thing about that that is like, it is, it's something that we're working with, you know? It's like, it's something that we have to become conscious of. You know, it's not altogether the worst thing in the world, but it's just something you have to be mindful of.
But what influence do you think that's having then on viewers? You know, on kids watching it.
Yeah, well, so
thinking, I mean, like, should I look like that? I mean, it is happening more to boys. Something that I've noticed is now something that's become even more prevalent is the body image for boys.
Look, when I was that age, when I was 13, 14, growing, I mean, I had full body dysmorphia because I was in the business, and so therefore it was like, it was so much more magnified for me. You know, and it was the source of surprising amount of despair, and you wouldn't think that looking at the kid that I was. And that's, so I think what you know you're getting at here is like, there is, I guess there's now more data showing us that boys struggle with it. I wonder if it's getting to the point where it's almost just as much. I mean, there's no doubt that young, that girls have faced something unique. Like, we don't want to forget that, but I do think that boys are now, there's just such image consciousness because there's images surrounding us, you know? And it's like, and I don't really feel like there's rarely ever, you know, some consciously bad person trying to, you know, turn these dials and stuff. This is just a product of the way that we think and make things and tell stories about ourselves. And so, you know, what is the antidote, or what is the sort of the positive opposite? I think letting younger people tell their own stories in some way, I think, is maybe a good thing. Like, you have so many adults writing stories about youth and then casting adults, and it's like, guys, this is not the way young people act.
Yeah.
It's not what it looks like when they do that. It's not what it feels like when they do that. You know, that I think would be positive.
After Gossip Girl, firstly, if you sign on to a project of that longevity, are you then more likely to go for film or something that's kind of less long-term, less commitment in terms of your shooting?
Yeah, so after Gossip Girl, I did. I mean, I did a series of independent films that all had really good scripts, really good casts, really great directors. And then they were all a bit hamstrung by a budget. So therefore, it was like I did one project after another where I saw increasingly, like, me thinking as a producer, like, I saw what kind of story gets money, what kind of story doesn't.
Yeah.
And so more and more I saw, you know, the kind of stories that I'm interested in telling, they're not really getting greenlit in the same way. They're not getting the same kind of budget. So then I actually turned entirely towards music.
Yes.
While I still could, while I was still living off that Gossip Girl check, you know? And did that for about 4 years. So yes, I mean, the answer to your question is, after Gossip Girl, I did not want to sign a contract for another show, probably ever.
Yeah.
And that's one of the reasons why I struggled with this one in the decision, knowing full well that possibly what could happen, what has happened, could
have happened.
Have happened.
Right, yeah, of course. So the longevity of this show. Because when you went in, did they say, okay?
Well, you signed a six-year contract.
Right.
So that's probably what people don't think about and isn't really that interesting, except for, you know, you can't make a short term. You're not allowed to.
Yeah. And then that obviously impacts those around you. This is not just a decision for
you. Yeah, it's a decision for your family.
Yeah.
You know?
And location shooting. So in this recent series.
Yeah, we have different city every season, which has been, you know, phenomenal.
How did you
during
find?
During COVID, by the way. Yeah, it's been a wild
what
ride.
What a treat.
Yeah, every season has been so different. My wife and I were just reflecting on that this past weekend. We were like thinking about how the impact, you know, we were thinking positively, but like just thinking about the impact that the show's had on our family, because I'd never had to make a professional decision that would impact my family. Before that, I didn't have a family, really. And we were sort of marveling at, like, how distinct every season has had and the different, like, kind of gifts and challenges that came along with it. And, you know, look, that's anything you do for, you do anything for 6 years, you're going to have highs, lows, everything in between.
Mm-hmm. So what was it like filming in London?
I love it here.
Yeah.
I loved filming here.
And this area, lovely.
Yeah. Right.
We're in Soho, by the way, listeners. We're here.
For a second, I was like, where are we? I don't know.
It's gorgeous.
It's the best city in the world,
some would argue.
I know that my wife and I right now, we would love the change of London, but moving here seriously is not in the near future for us, but we do love it here.
Well, I will recommend Finsbury Park as an area should you ever be looking. It's very lovely.
That's one that I don't feel like I recall. Where is it?
It's near King's Cross. It's okay. Like north, but very
You guys
lovely.
Talk about neighborhoods here like they're so they're
they, you've got you such talk about a them
like they're, bigger and further away from each other.
Yeah, so
it's like, oh no, that's it's like, oh, you mean it's right over there.
Yeah, it took me about 18 minutes to get here. So we can enjoy that. Anyway, so let's come on to you. So let's start with, does playing your character ever become hard to shake off when you're filming and you play a serial killer?
Mm-hmm.
Does it ever linger on you? Past the end of the shoot day?
Yeah, I think the way that it lingers is more like just the energy that it takes.
Yeah.
It's not for me, I'm not method in the way that, I'm not so in there in this, like, I think the way people imagine acting is like, you know, you get into some other state of mind and then you're like, you know, thinking differently. And maybe that's true for some people. That's not the way I ever experience it. I personally think we're kidding ourselves that we can actually think like someone else. No, that's you going through a whole exercise to feel as though you're thinking like someone else, but you're still very much you. It's impossible to not be you. And so I work with it in a very different way. That's to me a bit, it's like spiritual in that I want to take into account all the things, even the camera. I want to know what I'm doing, exactly what I'm doing, and actually have a totally spontaneous response if I can to all of it.
Okay.
And then say the things that I'm saying, and do the things that I have to do, which then actually, you know, your nervous system even does, like when you have to fake strangle somebody, your nervous system doesn't quite know that you're not strangling somebody. Or when you see a bunch of fake blood and you're stabbing somebody and it's coming out and it's like, you know, your physical system is not used to seeing something visceral like that happen and it being fake. So then it does take a toll, and there is an intensity that naturally I'm carrying around just while I'm at work. But I don't take it so seriously that that like it's a mindset that I have to somehow get out of, if that makes sense.
Yeah.
I think it's just hard to stop thinking, actually.
Yeah. Okay.
It's just because it is such an analytical and critical character, and that's maybe it.
You've spoken before about... or you've spoken out about kind of a lot of the broadcasters or the streaming services taking and fictionalizing serial killers and the problems that can cause. And also, you know, I've seen you replied to a tweet of someone saying, you know, kidnap me, please, saying, no, thanks, you know, and trying to make sure that there's a distinction between fiction and reality. But how do you handle that side of the job or the role in terms of, do you ever feel a responsibility?
Yeah, no, I do. I mean, again, my thinking is that anybody in my position has one. Everybody has a responsibility.
Yeah.
Everybody's got it.
Yeah.
Everybody's got one, two, not just themselves, two, to some degree, everyone around them.
Mm-hmm.
The fact that circle for me extends to, in some way, shape, or form, a whole lot of people. And I'm not saying that, like, I don't ever want to overestimate the influence of celebrity. I think we should actually take it down a couple notches with that. But there is a responsibility. You simply have it. Whether you choose to acknowledge it is, that's a different story. But, like, to act as though someone in my position doesn't have a responsibility, like, that's absurd.
Yeah.
That's like a parent not taking care of well, it's not the same, but it's like you have the responsibility, whether or not you choose to accept it as
a public responsibility.
Yeah, to some degree. And all I think that is like, hey, let's not act like this is the most important thing in the world.
Yeah.
there are other things, you know. Let's remember this is a fantastical storytelling exercise for a reason.
Yeah.
It has to have a reason. Like, we're thinking about things deeply here at some point, I would hope. You don't just want to disconnect. You don't just want to Netflix and chill. You know, like, you've got, there's meaning to it, right? There's a reason that all of us spend 6 months a year, 12 to 14 hours a day, if not more, making this story. It's not just fluff, you know? And the creators of the show think about this stuff so deeply. They always make it, like, incredibly emotionally resonant at the end of every season, like, no matter how crazy it gets.
Yeah.
And there's a reason, because it is like a worthwhile exercise and exploration. And so I just try to help people remember that, because the viewer does that work themselves. You know, I try to hold them in high regard and respect the viewer utmost. So I think when people come at me with that stuff, it was also kind of funny for a bit to play cultural referee, you know, and I'm not doing it as much now. Now I'm...
abstain.
now every aside I have about Netflix is that I'll take it up with Netflix.
You do that. So I want to talk to you about this, but I'm aware that it's been spoken about. So I think let's keep it brief and,
sure.
chat about something different.
Sure.
So I want to talk about the on-screen nudity and intimate scenes. Yeah. And before I started working at my current job, I did kind of an investigation into on-screen nudity and spoke to a number of actors about their experiences. And many of them had somewhat positive experiences, and others had, you know, a few horror stories and things like that. You've obviously said that you'd prefer not to do them. Do you think it's important that actors that have a profile, Emilia Clarke has also come out and said that, you know, she would prefer not to do them. When you have a profile and you have a platform for younger actors, because something that I realized when I did that investigation and I did that research was that a lot of young actors felt that the director was God, or that if they said no in advance, then they wouldn't be given the role. So, you know, do we need to be unpacking it from that stance as well, as in terms of it's not just about on-screen nudity and sex. It's actually more about how the industry approaches it and what happens if you don't want to be a part of that.
Of course, yeah. Yeah. I mean, me stating that boundary also naturally means that I'm interested in stories that just simply depict it in a different way.
Yeah. Do you think it's got more graphic as time?
I mean, I think everything has. Everything's gotten more graphic. You know, I mean, somebody asked me to, like, why just the sex? Why not the violence? It's like, yeah, sure, the violence too. Yeah. All of it. I'm just saying, look, when it comes to this simple boundary of human boundary, of the only thing that is real when you simulate it is touching or kissing somebody. That's a very simple fact. If I'm fake stabbing somebody, I'm not actually killing them.
Yeah.
That's okay. We can do that. Look, if somehow the role really calls for it and it's necessary, okay, fine, whatever. Do I also want to play a serial killer for the rest of my life? No. To me, this statement has been magnified, and it's interesting, and I could go there and all that stuff, but at the same time, it's kind of like normal, and I think should be normalized, and it's somewhat innocuous. It's like, look, I have a personal preference, and it is what it is. And I hope that as time goes on, you know, I'm not essentially hypocritical. So it's like, we'll see.
Yeah.
I think that it really should be unpacked from sort of every perspective. I mean, I think directors should think about it, writers should think about it, producers, actors. I mean, actors are, especially in the beginning, actors have no power. Like, I'm not asking people to cry about power here or cry for actors. I think, like, actors in the beginning are complete pawns. You know, you have no agency whatsoever. And only as you get more and more successful do you have what you could call agency. And even then, it's quite controlled, and it's in a narrow spectrum. But within that spectrum, you have a lot of it. So, you know, I finally felt comfortable to say, hey, this is where I'm at. How does that sound to you? And their response was, you know, really rewarding and encouraging.
Well, thank you very much, Ben,
for coming on the
Radio Times podcast.
Yeah.
Thank you for listening to the Radio Times podcast. We hope you enjoyed the show. If there's a guest you'd love to hear us interview, a program you've heard us talk about that has marked your life, or any other thoughts you'd like to share, please do write in to podcast@radiotimes.com. Please also remember to rate, review, and subscribe.